Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You're listening to a talk as part of the Designing Longitudinal Research in Complex Multiprofessional Environments conference, organised by the Scottish Child Care and Protection Network. This talk was recorded on the 20th of April 2011. Lucy Thompson, Public Health Resource Unit, NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde. Glasgow Parenting Support Framework Evaluation, School Readiness and Longitudinal Trajectories Using the Strengths and Difficulties Questionnaire, SDQ, and Linked Health Data.
I should briefly just say a little bit about what the Glasgow Parenting Support Framework actually is. It's one of these things that's evolved slightly over time, but essentially it's about giving all parents more support across the whole of Greater Glasgow and Clyde, although it has started off just in the Glasgow City area. The programme of choice has been the Triple P public health approach, which I can say more about, but it's less of the issue today. I'm here to talk about the evaluation side of things and specifically the work that we're doing on a whole population basis with the SDQ. The evaluation itself is a collaboration between NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde, the City Council Education Services and the University of Glasgow at the moment. I think as we go on, there's more and more parties are going to be brought in, but the information I'm presenting today is mainly with these parties. It's been funded by the Scottish Government, partly through the Fairer Scotland Fund and partly through some direct funding. And it involves many factors, which you'll get to see in a wee minute, but it involves the whole population assessments of social and emotional development at ages 30 months, 5 years, 7 years and 10 years. And that's the part that I'm going to focus on today in terms of mapping trajectories. I should say the prime aim is service evaluation rather than research per se. For those not familiar perhaps with NHS systems, there's a distinction made between what is research in terms of original research and what is either audit or service evaluation. If it's not research, then it doesn't require to go through normal ethical approval processes, and so it means that there's less of an onus to go through things like written informed consent in exactly the same way. Of course, we still follow research governance guidelines, but it actually does affect some of the practicalities of what we do. It's a service evaluation because Triple P has an evidence base already, but we are very keen to make sure we do a very thorough service evaluation because the implementation of Triple P on a population level approach, a public health approach like this, is still relatively novel. I would say the key factors to the evaluation is that it is collaborative. It's a truly collaborative project. We've got more or less buy-in from some sectors, but it includes local academic expertise and NHS input from a range of different levels, sometimes too many cooks, but from a range of levels. And I mean that right down to practitioner level, right up to strategic level, and that is quite important. It's multidisciplinary and multi-agency. We have a steering group that's been running for a couple of years now that involves people from a range of different settings and professions, which I think is quite important to the project. We have an administrative office, which at the moment only has the equivalent of one person staffing it, but that's growing as time goes on. We're at the start of the project, so we're in the process of building up our resource. Also, coordination communication. I guess that's probably the main thing that I spend half my life doing at the moment. Sometimes more than half my life is email wrangling and that sort of thing, which absolutely has to take place for this project to work. There's also the formal setting of regular meetings with admin staff and regular contact with the parenting coordinators. Glasgow has put parenting coordinators into place in each of its, well, it's now three sectors within Glasgow City to coordinate the implementation work happening. And some of the data collection happens through their offices, so it's essential that we have links with those parenting coordinators. We compose the evaluation according to a series of principles. The first one being that we had to focus on measurable child-centred outcomes, specifically that being one of the most important factors. We had to use standardised tools, apart from anything else, we wanted to be able to measure the impact on equity and the actual uptake of the programme. It's also really important that the data that we collect is useful to the people who are actually collecting it. It's kind of evaluation 101 that we have to actually make sure that the data are useful. So it's useful for professional decision making. It's useful for the people actually collecting it. It's useful for needs assessment. It can be used for performance management and very much is being used for performance management and, of course, for evaluation purposes as well. I've got four slides with all the research questions on, which is quite lengthy. It's more to give you an idea of all the different types of data that we're trying to collect in as quick an overview as I can. So the first slide talks about the reach and engagement with the PPP programme compared with projected population figures. And in those families that are engaging, what is the short-term impact in terms of basically the reducing risk and the building of resilience? And can we achieve our aim of 90% completion of pre- and post-intervention evaluation measures? My guess for the last question is no, but we've got to aim. And we're doing everything we can to try and obviously make sure. For those of you not familiar with PPP, for all the intervention levels, there are pre- and post-evaluation booklets that are used as part of the intervention but can also be used for evaluation. So that's what we're trying to make sure we get as many of those back as we can. And that's the data that will answer that middle question for us, is what are the kind of short to medium term impacts in terms of risk and protective factors. The reach and engagement one is an interesting one because there's different types of information we want to collect for that. We can easily say who's been attending PPP interventions to a point. Some of the one-to-one interventions that happen in primary care, health visitors, they don't necessarily always report to us when they're doing something because that's not how they normally do their job. They don't normally have to tell someone every time they've given somebody a bit of support around parenting that happens to involve this structured programme that they've been trained in. So there's a bit of a kind of, we're asking people to change the way they do things, and we're still working on making sure we get those data. It's easier when we have a situation where there's a level four group PPP happening and people are showing up. We've got their information. That's not a problem. One of the things we're struggling with collecting is whether people have been offered an intervention but haven't necessarily taken it up. These are the kind of subtleties of things that are a little bit more difficult to measure. This is more what I'm going to focus on today, which is the pattern of emotional behavioural problems in the population at each of those ages that I mentioned at the start. So there's a range of questions that just demonstrate the sorts of things that we hope to be able to answer from those data. And obviously we'll be looking at other data that we can relate to that as well. And I'll go into more detail about that in a minute. This is some more of the questions about offers uptake and completion of PPP in relation to what we're measuring about emotional behavioural difficulties. So we have different aspects of our data that we now want to try and bring together to try and answer some of the more complex questions about the kind of group differences within parents who are receiving or not receiving parenting support. And then there's a couple of questions about awareness raising. The population approach to PPP includes a marketing campaign, and the whole idea is that it destigmatises parenting support. It's something that everybody can have access to in theory, and we have got an advertising campaign and a marketing campaign, and we just need to get a sense of how people feel about that and whether people have become more aware of these things. The last two, rates of child injury, we can get from administrative data sets. And in terms of the last question refers to social work data. That's a work in progress. That's aspirational at the moment. We know the data exists, but we're still in the process of having the right person come sit on our steering group and actually discuss how we're going to go about doing that. So sorry, that's a bit of a whistle-stop tour, just to try and give you some of the context. But there are essentially three types of data. We've got the administrative data sets and the routinely gathered data. Child health surveillance systems, which includes a new universal contact with health visitors, which will be starting this year for children aged 2 to 2.5. That's being put back in place, and the content of that has been driven largely by some of the work we've been doing around parenting. Social work systems, and then there are other kind of bigger national data sets like Scottish Morbidity Record and data that are held at ISD. And then recently instigated routinely gathered data on emotional and behavioural wellbeing for children in the education system, which I'm going to say more about. And then, of course, there's all the process stuff in there as well, which I have to say it's probably what we've got more data on at the moment, because my managers are most interested in the performance management side of things and are people doing what we asked them to do or told them to do, as the case may be. So we've got a fair amount of that information too. But to focus on the social and emotional wellbeing, the strengths and difficulties questionnaire is our method of choice. I should say that the use of the SDQ in this way has been inspired by Clyde Hertzman's work with EDI in Canada. We didn't have the resource to actually put the EDI into place. It's a much bigger measure. The SDQ is shorter, and I'll give some pros as to why we're using it in Glasgow. But that's where the inspiration came from, and if you're familiar with Clyde's maps, you'll see that we've been very much inspired by his work. I should actually change the age three there. There's some as yet unpublished data that demonstrates you can use the SDQ as young as 2 years old. So that's what we're doing in Glasgow. We're using it in the new 2 to 2.5 year check. So it's a brief behavioural screening questionnaire. There are three different versions, parent, teacher and self-complete. You can use the self-complete version from when the child's around 10 years old. It's originally developed as a screening tool for psychological problems in children, but it's been very widely used and it can be used quite reliably as a screening instrument within kind of research criteria. It's quite sensitive and specific in that sort of context. It's still quite a broad brush. We need to be careful about how we're informing people about what it's for and what it can do. And of course, some people are quite nervous about using such a structured tool. That's what it looks like. Just thought I'd put that one in there because we always describe these things and we kind of want to just see what it looks like sometimes. These are the sorts of items you get. So consider other people's feelings, restless, overactive, can't stay still for long. This is the teacher version. The items are exactly the same in the other version as well. It's just that it talks about this child instead of your child. There's pretty much no difference beyond that. So these are the different stages of data collection that we've put in place. We've got the new routine 30-month health check by health visitors. So that'll be a parent version of the SDQ. There's also a language screen at that point, which is also really important and don't have time to talk about today, but I can tell you loads about that. We also have it in the preschool year, which is completed by nursery staff in the earlier establishments. That data collection's already started, and I can show you some of those preliminary data just today. The primary three, which is age seven, teacher complete, and the primary six, age 10, self-complete, are works in progress. We have agreement from the Director of Education that that can take place, but the actual practicalities as to how it's all going to work is yet to be sorted out. The intention is that it will start next year. So those children that we already have the preschool year from, those that were in the preschool year last year, currently in primary one, we should get them in primary three next year. So that's the intention. So this gives you an idea of the sorts of, again, this is the nice visual that Stephanie was talking about and partly inspired by Paul's work as well, and just let's get something visual so we can just see how we can track these children. What we already have is the preschool year, which we collected last year, and we should be able to gather those data, same data again in 2012. And obviously, we could potentially continue to gather those data because the SDQ has been put into the CMIS system, which is a data management system that the education services use for most of the local authorities in Scotland. So it's there, it's available, and it is now part of the transition process in Glasgow City. So as far as education services are currently concerned, that will continue to be collected every year and those data will be available to us. We paid for the development of that through some research funding, so... So technically, the dotted lines go beyond the life of our project, but we should be able to continue to do that. And then similarly, we've got the preschool year should then happen every year. And then we've got the 2.5-year-olds starting this year, and then hopefully the age 7 and the age 10 starting the following year. And it allows us to answer a range of questions, you know, the sorts of things we've already been talking about, the cross-sectional, the longitudinal, all different kind of permutations that that sort of data should be able to give us. This is a slide I made up last week in an attempt to try and show some of the complexities of the sorts of data that we've got. You've obviously got it all in front of you, but I'm going to take it stage by stage. So looking at the kind of life course from birth to teens, we should have four stages of data collection with the SDQ. The 30 months come from the Child Health Surveillance System. I should have noted on there as well, that's parent complete. So they're coming from different sources of respondent as well as different sources of data systems. The SDQ at preschool is from the CMIS system. I'm not sure where it's going to come from the 7 and 10-year-olds yet. I don't know if it'll be part of CMIS or if it'll have to be a paper exercise. We'll find that out as we start discussing it. I think that's kind of first agenda item for the next steering group meeting. And then, of course, these kind of paler... They don't come up very well here, just to demonstrate that obviously each of these can talk to each other, which is what I was demonstrating in the previous slide. We've then got a whole range of demographic information, which we'll get from a range of different sources and at different time points, and that can all relate to each of those different time points of SDQ data collection. We've then got the actual information on Triple P, which comes from, at the moment, from local administrative systems with the parenting coordinators. And we've got four different main domains that we're looking for there, is whether an intervention has been offered, whether a referral has been made, whether it's been taken up, and whether it's actually been completed or not. And then each of that data then also gives us demographic information, so there's a relationship there. Then there's social work involvement, which should come from social work data systems. And of course, all of those can potentially speak to each other as well. And although I've spaced these as if they are at the same time as each of the SDQ stages, they're not. They can be at any time in the child's life that we can potentially look at when they've had a triple P intervention, when they might have had some sort of involvement in social work. So this was just my kind of phase one of trying to develop some sort of picture of how all these data can potentially relate to each other. So at the moment, we have data for, ideally it was going to be for all children entering primary school in Glasgow starting last year. We got a wee bit lower than that, but I'll go into more detail in the next slide. It's completed by child development officers as part of the routine transition documentation that happens when children transition from preschool into primary school. It's part of a CMIS module. The data will be linkable to NHS and GROS data. That is something that we are working on. There's obviously all sorts of issues around linkage, but there seems to be good reason that we can link fairly well between NHS and education data specifically for this project. And it's potentially a way to measure how all preschool services are performing. In terms of our response rate, we got 70% of nurseries returning data last year. Now, what we've been told is about 97% of kids in Glasgow go into the school system. The extra 3%, bit of homeschooling, some children who aren't actually physically able to attend school because of their disabilities. But ultimately, most children are going to be part of this system. Where we didn't receive questionnaires back was mainly from partnership nurseries, the non-local authority nurseries, who hadn't had completion of this questionnaire written as their contract for last year. So quite understandably, they weren't willing to have this foisted upon them quite late in the academic year, I have to say. I've had some feedback directly, shall we say, not via education services, but directly to me from nurseries, and some of them were not happy, which is, you know, you live and learn. And I think I presumed that things would kind of be dealt with in a very kind of careful way, but of course they weren't necessarily for everybody. We now have it written into the contract, so for this year we do expect to get much closer to the full 97% of kids. So if the actual on a questionnaire by questionnaire basis, we actually had pretty good completion rates. We tend to lose data on a nursery by nursery basis rather than on an individual child basis. And what we've done, as I said, we've already been inspired by Clyde Hertzman, is we've done some mapping. And this is just to illustrate where our kind of starting point is in our mapping. This is the Scottish Index of Multiple Deprivation for the whole of Glasgow City. And you don't need rocket scientists to tell you the dark purple are the more deprived areas. Glasgow's got something like 90% of the most deprived families in Scotland. What we've done, though, not what we've done at all, what Bruce White has done at Glasgow Centre for Population Health is he's taken SIMD just within Glasgow and then split it up into quintiles so that it's actually more sensitive to what the variance is within Glasgow. And that's what this map represents. Again, the darker areas show those that are more deprived. Makes you feel a wee bit more cheerful, but then there's still quite a lot of dark happening there. I'll show you some more of the maps in a second, but these are some of the more sophisticated analyses that have been done on the data that we've got so far. This is the linear mixed effects model, which is adjusted for the establishment because there may be threshold effects, which I'll say a wee bit more about in a minute, and for geographical area. And you can see that actually the biggest, I don't know if you can see that, but it says looked after in care. So being a looked after or accommodated child gives you a 1.4 times more likely to have an abnormal score, for want of a better expression, which is perhaps not a terribly surprising finding, but I guess less surprising is that being male is also a pretty big risk factor, slightly higher than looked after or accommodated. Surprisingly, is younger children seem to be doing better, which doesn't actually fit with the literature, so that's something we're going to need to look at in a wee bit more detail. And then the four points at the bottom relate to SIMD, Scottish Index of Multiple Deprivation, compared with the most affluent part of the city. So you can see there's a clear kind of pattern there, around about 1.2 times more likely to have an abnormal score, as it were. And these are the different subscales. So there's some patterns there and some that don't really have patterns. So this is emotional symptoms. And this is the most deprived area in Glasgow, based on the Glasgow-only data, and this is the most affluent. There's not really much of a pattern going on there. Similarly, for conduct problems, there's pretty much not anything of a pattern going on there, bearing in mind this has been adjusted for establishment and for a geographical area. A bit more of a pattern here in relation to hyperactivity. So the more deprived have got higher levels of hyperactivity and the more affluent have got lower levels of hyperactivity, which goes in the direction that one might expect. Peer problems is the one over here. Slightly higher in the more deprived, but again, there's not a clear pattern there. This is pro-social behaviour. As my colleague Phil, who is principal investigator on this project, has said, it looks like posh kids are just nicer, more pleasant. It's one way to put it. Relatively posh, it's still within Glasgow. Total score, you can see there's definitely a gradient there according to SIMD. So there's definitely higher scores in the more deprived areas. But these are just, I have to stress, they are preliminary analyses because they're not complete data. And it's more that we're playing around with the figures right now to see what we can get. We're not planning on publishing these data. We originally were, but I think we just feel a wee bit more comfortable about waiting until we've got a fuller data set this year before we go ahead and do that. These maps are before the analyses were done, so these are not adjusted in any way. They are just the raw figures. And what we've done is we've got the background for SIMD, so the dark purple being the more deprived, and then we've put the patterning on top to demonstrate the prevalence of problems amongst the population that we have. So the ones with the dots on have got the lowest prevalence and the cross-hatching have got the highest prevalence. So for emotional symptoms, which we've already shown is not perhaps that variable between different areas, Bayliston seems to be doing fairly badly. I don't think there's anybody else that's got the cross-hatching. Funnily enough, Calton, East Centre, Shettleston seem to be doing the best in terms of emotional symptoms. Anybody who knows Glasgow might be a little bit surprised about that. We obviously need to do much more work with this to get to the bottom of that. Conduct problems is perhaps a slightly stronger indicator. And if you look, Springburn, North East have got the highest sorts of prevalence, a wee bit in Gerskad and Scotstoun Hill as well. That would fit with our violent crime figures, the kind of conduct problems. What's interesting is we have a very low prevalence in Govan, which slightly goes against what one might presume, especially if you come from Glasgow. Hyperactivity, let's see, the worst areas, East Central, Bayliston, Langside, slightly disturbing, that's where I live, and Greater Pollock and up in Drumchapel sort of area. So would probably go along with what we would expect. Again, Govan not doing terribly badly there. Peer problems. What was interesting about this one is one of the only area that's in the highest prevalence is Pollock Shields. Anybody that knows Glasgow knows Pollock Shields has got approximately 50% minority ethnic groups in its population. It's one of the only kind of intensive minority ethnic populations in Scotland. Why we think it's interesting is because growing up in Scotland also found a relationship between peer problems on the SDQ and minority ethnic group. So we don't know if that's what we're seeing here, but it's interesting and we'd like to look into it in more detail. Pro-social problems, again, Govan seems to be doing fairly well in that respect. North East Glasgow, Bayliston, Shettleston, not doing so well. Total difficulties. This is the total difficulty sums up the four more negative scales. And Springburn, North East, East Centre, Greater Pollock, Gerskad and Scotstoun Hill, not doing very well. Southside Central and Langside as well, quite depressingly. But Govan. Govan comes out on top, along with some others. Now, we might be dealing with a threshold effect there. That could be the normal for Govan effect, as we often call it in Glasgow. But we're not sure. We need to do more analyses to find out if there is a threshold effect going on or if there's genuinely something good about living in Govan for kids. So our plans, we need to obviously do a lot more work on these maps. We need to get a better, more robust data set this year. We need to disentangle the impact of neighbourhood deprivation, service use, all these sorts of things. There's a lot to be done on the linkage of the health and the education data. We have a separate research grant to look specifically into doing some of those data linkage. We need to look at the area effects, the effects of nursery, school, family on the trajectories. And there's also the designing of trials of interventions to reduce inequalities. Again, we've got some other research funding looking at specifically the 2 to 2.5 year screen and how we actually try and get in early and prevent some of those problems turning into something bigger at the preschool year and later on. We are doing some qualitative work, looking at user perspectives. Child development officers in the nurseries, heads of preschool establishments are currently being interviewed. We've got some feedback already. What will happen with this year's data collection is we'll talk to P1 teachers and primary heads as well. They didn't receive the SDQ data directly last year because it wasn't complete, and I think it was a bit late in the year that it was collected, so it was a little bit practically difficult. They will receive it this year, so we'd like to find out what they do with the information on the individual children, how useful it is to them. And of course, we absolutely have to check the child development officer scores against parent scores. We have to do some concurrent validity work on that, which we will be doing. This is some of the preliminary findings from the interviews, which were literally chucked in at the 11th hour. Our research assistant she's done a handful of interviews, but it really is quite preliminary at this stage. Some of the nursery staff have said it helps to think about children's social and emotional readiness for school rather than just their academic preparedness, which of course we know is the two are so tightly related anyway. That's why we've chosen to look at this. They're happy that it's consistent with the curriculum for excellence, which is obviously a huge change that they've had in education systems in the last year or so, and it's looking at the whole child, which is quite refreshing. There's concerns about parental consent and informing parents confidently. There was quite a range last year. We went out, myself and my colleague Phil went out and spoke to nursery heads, explained the whole project to them, but there were some that still seemed to feel that they required to send out written consent forms to parents. We've explained to them now that it's service evaluation, this is part of what you're doing. Of course you inform parents this is what you're doing and what the information is being used for, but don't feel it's a research project because it's not, it's just part of what you do. I think because it's a standardised questionnaire, it feels like a research project to a lot of the teachers, so we're having to kind of do a bit of hearts and minds work there. There were some concerns about committing negative information about a child to paper. One of the items in the SDQ, I don't know what your experience has been, Paul, but one of the items talks about lying and cheating. This child lies and cheats. And people don't like saying that about a 4.5-year-old child. It seems like a bit of a judgment to be making that, you know, some people are more able to take that in context than others, so we have to work on that. And there are concerns that actually, why are they doing this? Because the data won't be used. So that's why we're working. We're doing a lot of dissemination work with them, making sure they understand we are using the data. So that's all I'm going to say. That's just some acknowledgements there, obviously to Phil Wilson, because he and I are co-investigators on this project, and a whole host of other people in education services and the government, and Bruce at the Glasgow Centre for Population Health for providing those SIMD data for us.
This recording is copyright of IRIS 2011. It may be reused in the terms of Creative Commons licences, attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 2.5, UK Scotland licence. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.